It was just over 10 years ago in the city of Seattle, Washington. This was the setting for a shocking and brutal series of crimes by a serial mutilator who came to be known as the Hand Collector. But it wasn't until after he had stopped surgically removing women's hands that his story became the stuff of nightmares and legend. I'm Nathaniel Hensley. Welcome to A Scary Home Companion. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music and mayhem, fearful fiction and furious fact. Tall tales and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. Pour yourself three fingers, because this one is a doozy. Lucy Custer was the name of the first official victim of the Hand Collector. She was an area sex worker who one night walked into an ER with a neatly bandaged left arm stump and a head full of acid and painkillers. 3 months earlier, another area sex worker had been found dead in a landfill with one of her hands cut off. She'd bled out. The cops didn't connect the dots on this until much later. But this woman, still identified after a decade, seemed to be proof that the Hand Collector was trying very hard not to kill his victims. This first woman, the dead woman, she was an accident. The next attack didn't take place for 3 months. Obviously, he'd spent this time learning how to dress wounds. He wanted these women to live. He needed them to live. He just wanted their hands. Their left hands. After Lucy, the victims started to amass. There were 10 different women caught, mutilated, and released inside of 3 months. Prostitutes, homeless women, runaways, women of color. Women society had already discarded. And so this man was able to hunt them at will, and no one seemed to pay attention. Until he hit 10. At victim number 10, the press woke up. Double digits are just the kind of stats that can't be ignored. There were 7 more victims in the next 3 months, and it was always the same. A woman was abducted, drugged, and bound. Her hand was severed neatly at the wrist. The wound was clamped, closed, and bandaged, and then she was let go, usually near a hospital or a homeless shelter. He surely did want them to be alive. Did that make it a fetish? Or was it evil? If it was evil, was it tempered or unmitigated? Or was there another more sinister design at work here? The Seattle PD Handman Task Force finally caught a break with what ended up being victim number 18. A suspicious, anonymous tip led cops to a shoddy row house where they found victim number 18 bound to a metal bed frame, her hand already removed. The room had been rented under the name of Martin Rose. Later, when the photo of Martin Rose was shown to the victims, he was identified by all 18 of them. This was the man. And there was more than enough evidence inside this apartment to convict him of every single attack. But Martin Rose was not there. He was gone. Vanished into thin air, along with his entire collection. Allegedly, anecdotal evidence here, but allegedly, as victim number 18 was on the stretcher being carried out, she told the EMTs that the hands had come alive and crawled across the room, and that the hands had followed Martin Rose into the shadows and disappeared. After a good night's sleep and a healthy blood transfusion, this victim later recanted that story. What isn't alleged is that Martin Rose was gone, baby. Gone. After 6 months of a nationwide manhunt, came up goose eggs, the Handman Task Force was finally disbanded. And that is when the second wave started. First, it was the surviving victims. Lucy Custer, she electrocuted herself in the bathtub. They found her with an electric carving knife clenched in her teeth as she was trying to saw off her remaining hand. In the next few weeks, 6 more victims committed suicide. And then it was a morgue attendant. And then it was a crime scene analyst. An assistant DA who worked on the task force disappeared after apparently shooting both her parents. A second crime scene analyst chugged drain cleaner. A detective assigned to the case took a dive off a parking garage. And then her partner, another detective, cut off the hand of his 6-year-old daughter. It seemed like anyone connected to the hand collector case was cursed. Or so it seemed at the time. But as time passed, and with some distance, and the help of search engines to make the world news outlets feel a little smaller, I've come to the belief that this second wave of deaths was only setting the table for something much more insidious and much, much larger in scope.
Ago, the hand collector, Martin Rose, vanished without a trace. 9 years ago, one of the detectives on the task force for his case committed a copycat crime. David Ochoa severed the left hand of his daughter, who was just 6 years old at the time. Today I am joined by that girl. She's still a minor and has changed her name to avoid the press. So her name will stay anonymous. For the sake of this interview, I have called her Willow. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I know this is difficult, even after all this time.
Okay.
Willow, are you sure you want to talk?
Yeah, it's okay. It's probably good to put this out there. Everyone has the wrong idea about my dad.
But you understand why that is, though, right?
Yeah, duh. He cut off my flippin' hand. But, you know, there are two sides to every story.
So tell us the other side of it, please.
He was a good daddy. What happened to him wasn't his fault. He was trying to save me.
Do you believe that? Or do you believe that he believed that?
Yeah. I mean, both. I always knew he believed it. He cried when he did. Never saw him cry before, but he cried when he sawed my hand off. He was so sorry, but, you know, he didn't think he had a choice, really.
In his confession to the police, he said that he did it to spare you from the hand collector.
Who was going to take off both my hands, might I add? Dad made a sacrifice. He was, trying to save me.
That was a long time ago. How do you feel about it now?
I don't think he's crazy anymore, if that's what you're implying. Can I tell you about this dream I've been having?
Of course.
There's a man. He's real tall and skinny. Doesn't have any arms. I don't think he has lips either, because he's always smiling. Even when he talks, I've got a new baby sister. Half-sister, I guess. She's just a baby. In my dream, I walk up to her crib, and it's full of little hands. Baby hands. All cut off, but still crawling around. Like roaches when you turn on the lights. The hands are all over her. She starts screaming. And then I see that her hands are cut off, too. So it's like I get it now. It's so real. I can feel it. I can smell blood even after I wake up. This is what happened to my dad. The handman made him do it to me. Now he is trying to make me do it to her.
But, Willow, dreams are just dreams.
You don't really believe that. Do you?
Hey, it's our first ever reader submission. This is a poem called The Backwards Man, submitted by Penelope Hurst. Backwards Man had the worst of all fates. In life he suffered, in dying he suffered, in death he suffers eternal. Every day he wakes in the land of no sun, no moon, no stars. Every day the eldritch woman with gloves of human skin takes out her bone knives. Every day she flays him alive. Her touch is so light, she can peel one layer at a time. Skin, sinew, muscle, tendon. Until glistening white bone shines free. And then the backwards man, he lives it in reverse. The tendon, the muscle, the sinew, the skin, layer by layer, wraps back around his glistening bones. He rises despite the pain and he walks. He hunts, he searches, he quests. He looks for someone new, someone weak, someone desperate to feel something, anything, just to feel. The backwards man, he is looking for you. He wants to take your hand, he wants to take you back. He wants to take your place so that you will be the backwards man. Thanks, Penelope. Good stuff. If a little emo. If we ever make shirts, I'll make sure to send you one. If you have a poem, story, or a hot lick you want to unleash on the world, please send it to us at ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. Original content only, please. So why did he do it? Why was he collecting hands? Martin Rose was never caught. The hand collector was never truly brought to justice, so we will never know for sure. FBI profilers have opinions. True crime writers have opinions. I have an opinion. None of us have any substantial facts to work with. So what it is little more than idle speculation. That night, when police discovered the lair of the hand collector, that night when it became public knowledge who he was, by then he was gone, and he was never seen again. At this point, the handman attacks stopped cold. Sort of. There were the suicides, of course, the second wave, as I mentioned. And if you ask me, and let's just for a second assume that you did ask me, I think that the key to this series of crimes lays in that second wave and the third. You see, the police spent weeks going over every single inch of the boarding house room owned by Martin Rose. Every fiber, every hair, every print, every speck of blood, every single item bagged and tagged. They found blood samples for all 18 victims. They found crude altars that were covered in wax and crusted blood, which must have been pedestals for the hands. Most interesting of all, to me, they found a small collection of rare occult books and papers, one of which was a notorious book titled The Ghastly Ones. This is a book handwritten by a notorious cult leader from the 50s who claimed to be a sort of John the Baptist, a prophet for a race of demons. This was the very same book that was found in possession of the serial killer known as Barbed Wire Henry when he was captured in 1977. Allegedly, it had been destroyed in an evidence locker fire in 1979, and yet, here it was in 2008, in the possession of yet another serial killer. The book, allegedly, of course, details the process of evolving into one of these interdimensional demons. Part of this process involved collecting a harem of victims to feed upon after the evolution. I know this sounds crazy, but what if the hand collector solved that riddle that Barbed Wire Henry never could? Henry was caught, tried, convicted. He was executed. He never evolved. He just went to jail and died. But what if Martin Rose succeeded where this other murderer had failed? The second wave of hand collector-related deaths was the start of a whole new chapter. Now, in states all over the nation and nations all over the world, there were more and more reports of hand-related violence. Funeral home corpse mutilations, unsolved abductions, clusters of suicides, grave robbing, child snatching, recurring themes throughout all of night terrors and sleepwalking. Recurring descriptions throughout all from all of these victims that matched nightmares of a tall, thin man with no arms, his face twisted into a rictus grin. A boogeyman who presided over a swarm of rotting and disembodied hands. Was this a collective human nightmare bleeding through or into our dreams? Was it mass hysteria? Was it media hype? How could so many people with no apparent connection between them report so many of the same details? Had Martin Rose actually become more dangerous as an idea than he ever was as a living, breathing psychopath? No one can say with any certainty. Instead, I'd like to read a few headlines for you. I've culled these from various places over the last 10 years, ever since Martin Rose vanished. Seattle. Where is Martin Rose? Nationwide manhunt fruitless. Portland. Police suspect handman copycat responsible for recent attacks. Oakland. Severed hands mailed to OPD. But where is the victim? Lexington. Local teen dead, two Texarkana. Injured. Bizarre. Local accountant confesses to hand collector inspired killings. Armless corpse killings. Raises the specter. Of the hand. Richmond. Are millennials going too far with the handman challenge? Ontario. Sleep clinic fire. Luxury ruled white glove killer strikes again.
Thanks to technology, our world is smaller and more connected than ever before. But there are still a few corners of the globe that are yet to be explored. A few places that are truly remote. One of the most distant remote areas on Earth is East Timor. And my guest, Sheila Grasso, spent the last 3 years volunteering there as part of the Canadian Peace Corps. Sheila helped locals develop clean sources of water and also encountered a most unusual family. A family of outcasts, on the outskirts of an outcast nation. Recently, Sheila told me her story, and about how we are never really as far away from evil as we may think.
Even that far out, there was a farther out. I was working with a village of 5 families, less than 100 people, but there was a family that lived in the nearby hills. You know how city folk talk about country folk? That's how the villagers talked about this family. They were crazy, traditionally speaking. Literally an outcast, lunatic family. And recently they'd gotten even crazier. They said the mother of the tribe had severed the hands of everyone in the family. Everyone. It was pretty hard to believe, so when we finished in the village, we went into the hills to find that family. Maybe we could help them next. They met us on the edge of their farm. 7 sons, 3 daughters, and a lot of older people, too. Most of them had clavangs. That's like a machete. And all of them were missing their left hand. They weren't bandaged, either. The wounds were totally healed. They had strung up all their hand bones along the doorways of their huts. Like wind chimes. I asked if we could help them, and the oldest woman there shouted at us that we had brought the Kula Sekta with us from our land. Roughly translated, Kula Sekta means devil with no arms.
Martin Rose terrified the city of Seattle, but news of his crimes hardly spread outside the state, let alone the country. Could he really have inspired a copycat crime on the other side of the world? Is that possible? How would it be possible? Unless there's another explanation. Evil ideas travel by communication, a whisper, a blog post, a book, don't they? But what if they don't?
In the 1990s, Wired magazine defined a meme as an idea that functioned in a mind the same way that genes and viruses function in the body. So, in much the same way that viruses can leap from body to body, an infectious or a viral idea might leap from mind to mind. Which leads to the question, how does it leap?
Late night, my shoes are worn. In a diner, it's 2 a.m. And I wonder, what will I do tonight? Cup of coffee and a cigarette more. Clock above me reads 2:04. In the night hours, all got a story to tell. The girl with the short hair's parents won't speak to her no more. They call her an unholy dyke and they call her a whore. Oh well. Order a bagel, butter and all. Think to myself as I stare at the wall, killing time, counting change in my hand. Dark man sits on my right, shades keeping his eyes out of light. Drinks his coffee just as black as his skin. And the man with the pack and the black hat sits in the back. White eyes glow like a fire burns bright in the act. Whoa, and the fat man comes in with little hair. His wife is unfaithful, but he doesn't care. As long as he can hold her tight at night. Damn, the waitress truly is a poet now. Writes her stories on a paper towel to publish them someday, she says she might. And the man in the back tips his hat as he stands and he grins. The first word he says all night, let the show begin. Julie wants to have some fun, so she takes a butter knife and cuts her fingers off one by one to find a problem when she tries to start on her next hand. Yeah, and the fat man strips down the horse, cries to herself and defecates on the floor. I don't think I want the second half of my bedroom no more. The fat man started to say how he wants to kill his wife. As a dyke puts off his tongue with a jacket knife, he keeps an apology. pocket. And the two are making passionate love in the dark. Blind man thinks he's seen enough, so he takes to his pen from her right hand. Then he stabs his eyes as according to plan. Cause the man in the back simply laughs and smiles, and the blood spills out on the linoleum tile. And the fat man starts to eat the flesh of the whore. Yeah, the moon's a little different as the minute
is hot and he smiles. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of A Scary Home Companion. The Scary Home Companion is written and directed by Nathaniel Hensley and produced and edited by myself, Carl Offenberg. That first song you heard was called Return to the Black Star by the Deep Space Destructors. The song after Marianne's first interview was No Hands by Lemon Yellow Haze. We closed out today's episode with The Devil's Bagel by Rusty Cage. You can check out more of Rusty's music at rustycage.bandcamp.com. If you'd like your music or content featured on our show, shoot us an email at ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com. Our opening theme was written and recorded for us by the very talented Chelsea Oxendine. Our interviewer, Marianne Simpson, was played, as always, by the wonderful Jamie Hensley. Willow was played by Savannah Hensley, and Sheila Grasso was played by Sarah Hansen. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget to like and subscribe.